The National Rifle Association's caused anger exactly 1 week after 26 people were shot dead in the school massacre in Connecticut. Its vice president has been defending the right to carry weapons. Wayne LaPierre ignored interruptions from protesters during a news conference and pushed for armed police to be placed in every American school.
To stop a monster from killing our kids is to be personally involved and invested in a plan of absolute protection. The only thing that stops a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun.
Meanwhile, residents of Newtown have observed a minute's silence in memory of those killed at Sandy Hook Primary School. Signalling failures and flooding are causing disruption on the trains and roads as most people finish work for their Christmas break. Rail services have been disrupted at London Paddington and Brighton, affecting Heathrow and Gatwick airports. A former army doctor has been struck off the medical register over the death of an Iraqi detainee who was beaten by British troops. Derek Kilo failed to spot 93 injuries on Baha Musa, who died in custody in Basra in 2003. BAE Systems has signed a £2.5 billion deal with Oman for the sale of 20 military aircraft. Unions say it will help sustain thousands of jobs in the UK. And Gangnam Style has become the first video to be viewed more than a billion times on YouTube. Its trademark dance has made South Korean singer Psy an international superstar. That's the latest. I'm Stuart Duggan.
Hello, Bristol. Welcome to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and helping us review this week's news is a Bristol-born former army officer who also happens to be the longest-serving member of the Conservative Party anywhere in the world, Harry Beckoff. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, a parliament is only as good as its opposition leader. Well, after Labour leader Ed Miliband has fallen behind even Nick Clegg in the polls, could Labour ever be a revived force to stick up for the 99%? We have an exclusive interview with the Labour leadership candidate John McDonnell. Plus, the United States of Europe. As David Cameron openly talks of leaving the EU this week, I'll be asking Harry what he makes of our prospects in Europe. Also, getting to the root of the financial crisis, London-based Islamic think tank Global Vision 2000 has been doing some thought-provoking excavations, plus Martin Summers' weekly tour of the world's hotspots, all in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 6 degrees Celsius and dry this weekend, highs of 13. It's rather mild, actually. Very heavy rain on Saturday with some strong winds, dry on Sunday, but still a little windy. Next week, highs of 11 Celsius, a fairly cloudy Christmas week, but with some sunshine and a few showers. On Christmas Day, it looks sunny. Next weekend, 29th and 20th and 30th of December, highs of 10 Celsius, some sunshine and showers. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Well, time to introduce this week's guests, and helping us review this week's news, I'm really pleased to have in the studio Bristol-born former army officer, who also happens to be the longest-serving member of the Conservative Party anywhere in the world, Harry Beckoff. Hi, Harry, and welcome to Drive Time.
Thank you.
Now, first of all, what were you actually doing in the army, you know, during the war? What was going on there?
Well, I enlisted in 1940... and they put me in the Royal Engineers, where I reached the rank of Lance Corporal, and then they realised that I'd done army training, so they sent me to Catterick to become an artillery officer. Eventually, I found myself in Quetta, up in the north of India, and the Secret Service sent emissaries to get me out of there and bring me back to a place called Station X in England, where I was to be trained as a codebreaker. The reason they chose me was because they discovered that I had an honours degree in German from my University of Bristol. So I was flown out to the Western Desert to join the 8th Army to try to break Rommel's signals and give Montgomery the information he badly needed of the disposition and the strength of Rommel and his Africa Corps. And that was what I was doing until the victory at El Alamein, when the 8th Army was victorious and Rommel ran away. I was then sent back to India and to Burma to try to break the Japanese codes, just as I had done the German codes. But of course I was an expert on German, didn't know any Japanese, but the message in the army in those days was, if you can do one thing, you can do another. And so I learnt Japanese.
Amazing. Now, one of the things, obviously, you met Winston Churchill, you knew Winston Churchill, he gave you your degree. Tell us what kind of man he was.
I had just returned from Germany in 1933, where I saw Hitler come into power, and I saw the Nazis marching about and burning books. And I came back and reported to Churchill, who was then Chancellor of Bristol University, and he said, come and have a discussion. And he said to me, unfortunately, there is a strong movement in this country against me wanting to come to terms with the Germans. And if we do that, we'd be their slaves forever. So what you have to do is to write to all the newspapers, try to influence people to understand the true situation in Germany. And that was a mission that he gave me.
So how did you do that? What did you, were you writing to newspapers? And
yes.
Do you think you played a part then in getting Churchill more accepted? Because I know, for example, Churchill found it impossible in the 1930s to actually get heard on the BBC, because Lord Reith was actually, who ran the BBC at the time, was very pro-Hitler. So what changed that got Churchill into power and that actually started to get a debate going in Britain, which said, no, we can't actually come to terms with this man?
There was such a strong anti-Churchill movement that they removed him from every office he held and pushed him into the background. The newspapers refused to write his stories. The publishers refused to publish his books. He was left out in the wilderness. For instance, he had been in senior position in the Navy. They took it away from him and confined him to the back benches. He literally went through hell. The newspapers wrote against him, they voted against him in Parliament, until the final day when they realised what he really meant. Then everything changed.
Now, Harry, you're now 98 years old, amazing age you've managed to make it to, and also thanks very much for managing to make it into the studio here today. You've been a member of the Conservative Party since you were 15 years old, the oldest member of the party in the country. I'll ask you in a minute about what you think of modern politics, but tell us, since the war, you've been a very active person, haven't you? And you've been writing books and that kind of thing. Tell us about those books.
Well, having studied in Germany, I went deeply into the history of Germany from the time of Charlemagne and the time when the wild tribes invaded Rome, and realized that these were dangerous people. And so I studied the history and wrote a book called The Four Reichs. That's the four empires from Charlemagne until Hitler. And then when I finally wrote another book showing how the Germans were back into power, how they were getting money from some different sources to buy up major British and American firms and take them over as fast as they could. In other words, by hook or by crook, Germany was coming back to take over command, as she's always wished to do, of the whole of Europe. By Jove, she is now there in total command of Europe. She is the strongest force in Europe. Nobody, no other nation can compare with her.
Now, I have to take issue with you there, Harry, because the Conservative leader, the Prime Minister David Cameron, even just this week, is saying that it now looks as if we may have to leave the EU. So that may take Britain out of the sort of influence that Germany has. That's what Mr. Cameron's saying this week.
Well, I have fought against the European Union ever since it started. And in this last couple of years, the newspapers have begun to realize the truth of what we've been saying. And so they've been turning Eurosceptic as hard as possible. Now, Mr. Cameron, for some odd reason, has stated more than once that he has no desire and no intention of leaving the European Union. But on the other hand, there is a growing number of members of Parliament who are distinctly in favour of leaving the European Union, which puts Mr. Cameron in a difficult situation. And sooner or later, this is going to have to be resolved within the next year or two, by the time of the next election. Do we opt out of America, of Europe, or do we stay as he wishes? I think you'll find the majority of people in this country are getting stronger and stronger to leave the European Union and find our own way forward, as we did in the past.
But there are many people, Harry, who say that the European Union has actually been good for us. It's meant that there hasn't been a major conflagration in Europe ever since the end of the Second World War. It's kept the peace.
The European Union hasn't kept the peace. It's the countries led by Britain who've kept the peace. And as for the European Union being of good value to us, what happened to all our fisheries? We can't even fish in our own fishing grounds. They've taken the strength away from our farmers. They've cut our country down to a mere rump of what it used to be, so that we can't even afford to carry a good army and navy any longer. The European Union claims that it's good for our trade. We're actually doing more trade now outside the European Union than inside. So these are all stories which have no foundation of truth.
Well, thanks, Harry. We're also joined by Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Martin, this week we've heard, again, in a way, sort of backing up what Harry's just been saying, that plans aren't going too well with George Osborne and the economy, that we're having to actually borrow quite a lot more money than we thought we were going to have to borrow this month. The trouble is, with all of these, every time we hear that we're having to borrow an extra $2 billion or whatever, it puts out all those future calculations, doesn't it, as to whether this plan that they're adopting, the austerity plan at the moment, is actually going to sort out our economy.
Well, as I understand it, the whole purpose of keeping the pound was to allow us room for manoeuvre in a situation like this. And it's the Germans and Angela Merkel who are forcing austerity on southern Europe, and which is, of course, is counterproductive. I mean, this is what they, what we as a species, I suppose, learned in the 1930s, that if you've got a kind of recessionary, deflationary wave, cutting public expenditure doesn't solve your problem. It just increases the deflationary wave and actually leads to deficits increasing rather than decreasing. Now, surely the whole point of having an independent policy in Britain, and it was Gordon Brown who actually put the kibosh on the idea of joining the euro, the idea is that you pursue an independent policy. And what seems to be happening is that we're pursuing an independent policy. It just happens to be exactly the same as the one being pursued by the Germans and the Europeans. That seems to me to be silly. If we're going to have the pound, and we have got the pound, perhaps we should be pursuing policy rather different from the ones that are being pursued on the other side of the channel.
Harry, what do you make of that? Because what Martin's saying is, even though we're outside the euro, we're still virtually moving in parallel with these other European countries such as France and Germany.
That's a clever work behind the European Union. They've got us so involved that although Gordon Brown managed to keep us out of the euro, they still extract billions of pounds from us every year to help sustain the other countries who are still in the euro. So they're cutting us up both ways.
Interesting way of looking at it. Okay. Well, it's not just a Conservative government. Some people seem to think it is at the moment. It's a coalition government with the Liberal Democrats. And there's a bit of an anniversary this week because the leader of the Liberal Democrats, Nick Clegg, is having his fifth anniversary as leader. And I just took a little extract from his speech on Monday. So let's have a listen to that now. What's Nick Clegg got to say for himself?
We've embraced the challenge of building an enabling state that acts where necessary and backs off where not, promoting, inspiring and facilitating growth and opportunity, but recognising that the strong economy we want can only be built on the back of hard work and responsibility by citizens themselves. So we've been on a journey, but our journey has been towards the centre ground, not away from it, because the centre ground is where Liberals are best able to fulfil our purpose in politics. For Liberal Democrats, our purpose is quite simply to enable every person to be who they want to be and to get on in life. Freedom and opportunity combined, or what the philosophers might call substantive freedom. To deliver on our purpose, we need to build a stronger economy in a fairer society.
Harry, you couldn't, as Conservatives, be running the country now if it wasn't for the help of Nick Clegg. So what do you make of his speech there after 5 years in charge?
Not very much. He does not make out a constructive policy. The Lib Dems wish to stay in with the European Union. They have no sound basis or foundation from which to work themselves. They have a number of odd policies, some of which are counter to the policies which the Conservative Party wish to bring in to help the people of this country. So there is a battle going on all the time, and sooner or later this is going to have to be resolved one way or another, I think possibly before the next election.
Is that something you'd agree with, Martin?
I think that's right. I think the tensions within the coalition probably will lead to a breakup before the next general election, which is penciled in for 2014. I think what may happen in 2013 is we could have a major financial crisis. We haven't had a major financial crisis yet. The state stepped in 2008 and propped up the banking system. The state all over the world, the British state, the EU state, the American state, are running out of resources to do that. And so a real crisis will probably break in the new year, which will probably break our government along with lots of other furniture and crockery. And I think also, just picking up on what Nick Clegg was saying there, that the centre ground, or the middle of the road, that in the famous words of a Labour MP of yesteryear, whose name I've forgotten, is where you get run over. And I'm afraid that's what's happening to the Liberal Democrats. They're being run over by standing in the middle of the road.
Well, one of the things Harry mentioned a little while ago was the book burning and the lack of freedom of expression in both in Nazi Germany and actually here in Britain in the run-up to the Second World War. Somebody whose cause is that's rather close to his heart is someone called Julian Assange. Now, he is inside the Ecuadorian embassy, and as the fact that he's been in there for 6 months, he gave a speech yesterday on the balcony. It's almost like some sort of revolutionary leader comes out every once in a while to talk to the people and then runs back off inside again. The fact that he'd made the speech was reported on the mainstream press, but very little of his actual speech himself, if any, was. So let's have a listen now to what probably the most radical publisher in the world right now had to say on the balcony yesterday in Grosvenor, just on the edge of Grosvenor Square. That is Julian Assange.
I salute journalists and publications who continue publishing the truth in face of persecution, prosecution and threat, who take journalism and publishing seriously, because it is from the revelation of truth that all else follows. Our buildings can only be as tall as their bricks are strong. Our civilization is only as strong as its ideas are true. When our buildings are erected by the corrupt, when their cement is cut with dirt, when pristine steel is replaced by scrap, our buildings are not safe to live in. And when our media is corrupt, when our academics are timid, when our history is filled with half-truths and lies, our civilization will never be just. It will never reach to the sky. In 2013, we continue to stand up to bullies. The Ecuadorian government and the governments of Latin America have shown how cooperating through shared values can embolden governments to stand up to coercion and support self-determination. Their governments threaten no one, attack no one, send drones at no one, but together they stand strong and independent. The tide calls of Washington power brokers for economic sanctions against Ecuador simply for defending my rights are misguided and wrong. President Correa rightly said Ecuador's principles are not for sale. We must unite together to defend the courageous people of Ecuador, to defend them against intervention in their economy and interference in their elections next year. The power of people speaking up and resisting together terrifies corrupt and undemocratic power. So much so that ordinary people here in the West are now the enemy of governments, an enemy to be watched, an enemy to be controlled and to be impoverished. True democracy is not the White House. True democracy is not Canberra. True democracy is the resistance of people armed with the truth against lies from Tahrir to right here in London.
Well, pretty strong words there from Julian Assange, as not heard on the BBC News last night. Harry, is it an exaggeration to say that what he's doing there, it compares to the sort of experience that there was when you were over in Germany and when you were here in the run-up to the Second World War? Because he's essentially saying there that there's tremendous corruption within our big press, that is to say the national press, that they're not really dealing with the issues that they should be dealing with. And he's even there saying that our government today sees ordinary people as the enemy. I mean, that's a pretty scary thought.
Well, our people are beginning to wake up as a whole to the true situation of the European Union. There is no valid freedom for us whilst the European Union commands the law, and the laws are passed direct from Brussels through our parliament without stopping. So we are no longer making our laws, and the British law taught the whole world the value of freedom. Freedom under the law means that a man is free to come and go as he wills, until, and he remains innocent until he's proven guilty. That is quite contrary to European law, which has a man guilty first who has to prove his own innocence. Now, we need to be back on our own island, but we are not alone. We're doing now more business outside the European Union than we did inside, and we have with us our Commonwealth, which has been neglected for far too long. Our Commonwealth is improving, is getting stronger. Our people are beginning to realize that. Our people are demanding that we cling back to the Commonwealth and the loyalty of our friends and allies and make our own way forward again.
Martin, Julian Assange, probably the most powerful thing he was saying there, and I'd just like to hear whether you think he's telling the truth or not, is that maybe he's getting a bit paranoid inside that embassy, who knows? But he's saying that the enemy is becoming the ordinary people and that they're being deliberately impoverished by the ruling classes.
Well, I think that's always been true. I mean, let's face it, ruling classes rule, whether it's in today's world or in the world that previously existed. And with, you know, the power structures exist which make ordinary people pawns in their games, and that includes the European Union, but it also includes NATO, for example. It includes the Bilderberg Group, the Trilateral Commission. There's a whole series of clubs, if you like, which the really powerful people belong to, and they're overlapping memberships. And a lot of democracy, frankly, is and always has been a facade. That doesn't mean that the principles of democracy should be forgotten about. We just have to recognise that in the real world, overmighty subjects, powerful barons, people with pull and influence, whether it's in Europe or elsewhere, generally do decide things, and ordinary people are moved around as pawns, and it has always been like that, but it's a constant struggle to improve the situation.
And it's probably worth reminding ourselves of just what WikiLeaks has achieved over the last few years, with revealing footage, for example, of Reuters cameramen being killed out in Iraq. There's been a tremendous amount of that just in this last year. Probably one of the most powerful leaks was the revelation of something called the Trap Wire system, which is in the United States, and also apparently being introduced by Downing Street, which is a network of surveillance cameras, all that go to a central point. It's one of these kind of nightmarish Orwellian surveillance things. It also then will link into people's personal information, like a sort of super database where people can be followed almost by computers. What are your thoughts about this modern, because I know you use the computer, Harry, don't you? Even though you're 98 years old, you're quite computer savvy, about the value of something like WikiLeaks and what they do.
All means of communication have their own values. WikiLeaks, Google, they're all helping us to find our way through the jungle of present politics, which for some people are still anathema. It's very difficult when you consider that the laws which go through our parliament are not made by our parliament. More than three quarters of those laws come from the European Union. Now what we need again is our liberty to make our own laws in our own parliament without having interference from outside.
What would you say to people who, you know, will apathetic, as a lot of people in Britain, you're saying yourself there, that it's not Westminster that's making these laws. A lot of people are apathetic. They don't even think there's a point in voting. What would you say to them?
It's a queer situation. I think the British people have become so used to winning every combat, every situation, that they think it's impossible for us to lose any situation now or in the future. Of course, this is not the case. We need our services to protect us. We need the Army, the Air Force, the Navy. We need the territorials. We need the civilians. We need the will of the people to stand up for our country and resist the takeover of countries like Germany, which now rules Europe. It's for us to withstand that and declare ourselves free of the European Union and all outside influences.
But you mean you don't obviously like the EU, the Brussels EU, but surely you know there are lots and lots, there are millions, a vast majority of ordinary German people have got no sort of megalomaniac type ambitions. They're just ordinary people like you and I.
You would be surprised at the vast numbers of Germans who are also anti-EU. And what's more, they're also anti-Euro. And they want to get back to their old trusted D-mark currency. So don't believe that the German people are doing exactly as their masters want them to do. There is some kind of a revolution stirring up in Germany, which is against the present rule.
Martin, I'm going to ask you to finish on this point. What are your predictions for 2013 with this so-called Euro crisis? It's one of those things, it's almost like the same cartoon repeated again and again, week after week on the TV. Another summit, another Euro crisis, another fudge, another kicking the can down the road. What's your prediction for 2013? Is there going to be any kind of solution to that, or is it just going to carry on?
Well, I mean, it all depends upon whether the markets buy the European Stability Facility as a mechanism for propping the euro up. I mean, basically, when François Hollande won the presidential election in France, he basically said to the Germans, basically, and Angela Merkel, look, you've got to put some German muscle behind this European Stability Facility to make the euro stable. But of course, even with Germany's vast resources, they can't bet against the derivatives market. And the fact is that sooner or later, some country is going to default on the deals that have been done, whether it's Greece, Spain, Portugal, or Italy. And once one of those countries does fail in and default, I mean, Greece has been given a bung to keep them sweet until after the German elections. But it's a very rickety three wheels on my wagon sort of a setup. But of course, what people must realise that if the euro collapses in chaos, that will bring down the British banking system and the US banking system in the tsunami that will follow. So the euro is a symptom of the fact that the banking system, frankly, is insolvent and has been for the last 4 years.
Is it fair to ask you, Harry, what your predictions are for this euro crisis? Is it just going to keep chugging along month after month, year after year?
Well, following our last speaker, it's a strange thing that the Americans are insisting that we should stay in the EU because it's better for them. The question is, what's better for us? And best for us is to have our own freedom again with our own currency and our own commonwealth and pursuing what we know to be right and proper. I ask you a simple question. Who provided the money to put Hitler into power? He had no money of his own. He'd been a prisoner. He'd been in prison for years. He had no resources at all. Yet suddenly this man was able to provide all the money necessary to set up the Nazis and even to take over the German government. A man who wasn't even efficient in any way as a statesman, nor had he served of anything except a Lance Corporal. I ask you these questions. What is the power of money behind all the countries yesterday and today?
Good question. Well, we'll have to ponder that one over the break. On to our next story. And we have, for the last week, had the privilege online of being able to watch, for the first time, a film called Unlawful Killing. This is a film made by Victor Lewis Smith, who has a column in Private Eye, and also a chap called Keith Allen, who's possibly even more famous for his daughter, Lily Allen, who's a pop singer. And it's about the death of Princess Diana. It's also about the inquest. In fact, Keith Allen himself calls it the inquest into the inquest. Now, that's been online, helped by some Bristol people for the last week or so. Now, apparently, it's not online. I may just do a check now to see if you can get it still online. But the reason being is because after a year of since the documentary was made, it's still not been shown anywhere in Britain, which is a great pity. Anyway, here's an extract from it now. And then afterwards, after the 2.2 million downloads, allegedly, anyway, that's what I was told, that this film has had since it was put online last weekend. Now it's now not there, but let's have a little listen to this extract from the band film called Unlawful Killing by Keith Allen, all about the death and inquest of Princess Diana.
In 1997, the death of a princess and her lover rocked the world. 10 years later, it led to the longest, most expensive and most sensational inquest in British legal history. Hundreds of witnesses were called. There were arguments, lies, tears and accusations as intimate details of their private lives were dissected on the world stage. Yet before the court case had even begun, the media had already decided what the verdict should be. However, in Britain and around the world, millions of ordinary people were convinced, and after the inquest still are convinced, that the deaths of Princess Diana and Dodi Fayed were no accident.
I think it's murder.
Murder.
My own opinion, there can be no doubt that she was actually murdered.
When the woman left a note saying, FYI, if I'm dead, here's how it's going to happen, and then it happens exactly like that, I think someone should pay attention.
I mean, I just know our initial reaction was, well, they finally killed her, because we're used to it.
I think it'd be murder.
If you go to a bar, you'll find three people go, ooh, but the royals did it, didn't they?
Oh, of course Diana was bumped off. She knew she was going to be bumped off.
I wasn't sure if Diana's death was an accident or murder, but I suspected a cover-up by the British establishment, an elaborate exercise in burying the truth rather than uncovering it. I suspected a conspiracy, but this isn't just the old story about a conspiracy before the crash, it's about a conspiracy after the crash.
We all know that the biggest scandals are always the cover-ups. I mean, it isn't the Watergate, it's not the break-in, it's the cover-up which is the big scandal.
When you have the head of the
British security services calmly announcing we have never killed anybody in the last 50 years, I laughed out loud. What's the point of them then? I didn't believe it. And so if you don't believe that, where does that leave the rest of the establishment evidence?
I decided to watch and wait, then tell the story that the press and TV news wouldn't tell. The result is a documentary that reveals what really happened during those 6 months in the Royal Courts of Justice. The inquest was held in the royal family's own court, so is it any wonder that the coroner, the royal representative in charge, decided that the key royal suspects need not even appear at the inquest to be questioned?
There's an extract there from the very start of that hour and a half long documentary about the death, some would say assassination or murder, many people did say murder just then, of Princess Diana. Harry, I'll come to you first. First of all, what are your thoughts about why this documentary still hasn't been shown a year after it was made?
Well, I loved Princess Diana without any fear or favour. And I firmly believe she was hard done by, and I question the manner of her death. So I am not prepared to accept the explanations given so glibly. Personally, I would like to see the whole thing open, wide open, so that the real truth could be revealed.
I mean, that documentary is called Unlawful Killing because that was the verdict at the end of the inquest. Now. Yes. Essentially, that means she was murdered. If she was killed unlawfully, one of the things that it's explained in the film very clearly is that there were several high-powered motorbikes plus a white Fiat Uno going along with right next to the Mercedes when the crash took place. And the jury took a long time, a lot of deliberation, and then decided that it was actually these individuals on these motorbikes and in this Fiat Uno who were responsible for her death. But this is simply something which has not really got out. It didn't even get out at the time, hardly, through the press coverage. Martin, what are your thoughts about this film being, for a start, I suppose, the conclusions that the film comes to about the murder of Diana? I mean, we're still talking about it as an accident, but actually the inquest said it was a murder. And then about the reasons for censoring this film.
Well, it does seem odd, doesn't it? You'd have thought if the establishment had nothing to hide, they'd be perfectly happy for a film to be shown. And of course, in this day and age, it's not like the Spycatcher affair back in the 80s where the author had to go to Australia and publish on the other side of the world. We now have the internet. If 2 million people have downloaded or seen this film in the last week, then it's out there anyway, despite attempts to ban it, which is why banning films, and coming back to WikiLeaks earlier, trying to ban stuff is virtually impossible in today's world. And the establishments here and elsewhere are running around trying to close the stable door after the horse has bolted a long time ago. So, you know, people are going to find out what they're interested in by doing a simple computer search, and attempts to prevent them doing so are misguided.
Well, the reason it was put up on the internet, actually in Brazil, hosted in Brazil, I believe, because it's perfectly legal to do that, and you can watch something in Brazil, but apparently if the servers are in the UK, it would be a lot easier to stop them, was because this film has been made, it's been sitting on the shelf for a year.
Was it the Cannes Film Festival? Was it not?
That's right. It's been sitting on the shelf for a year, still not being seen anywhere in Britain, apart from possibly over the last few days on computer screens. It's been shown in Ireland, for example, in film festivals there, but not here. So anyway, we shall see. Hopefully people will have managed to catch a copy of that, or at least be able to find it. It was on a website called uncovered-truth.com, but now it's come down. There may at least be some more extracts available, but anyway, hopefully in the future we shall see a little bit more of that kind of thing.
I think we should also consider Diana's sons and take into consideration their feelings, their reactions. They were deeply attached to their mother, and I believe still are, and I feel that nothing should be done without their permission being sought first of all.
But I mean, this is an investigative documentary. Ultimately, what the documentary is doing is it's pulling on various people who were at the inquest, and it's using the information from the police inquiries and from the actual transcripts from the inquest itself. So Whether it's actually whether William and Harry should have a veto is a whole another question over whether a film is shown. Certainly, it's the royal family that have put legal threats on the people, and that's one of the reasons it's not been shown publicly in Britain yet. But ultimately, I think Martin's right. It's impossible to stop a film being shown. Very, very difficult to do that. Whether William and Harry are trying to do it or not, but I would suggest that they may be, and we don't know. They may be happy for it to be shown because they may want to set some of the information about their mother's inquest to be more public. Okay, on to our next story, and we're going to go to the Houses of Parliament now and have a listen to Prime Minister's questions. The first question we have this week is really relating to white collar crime and fraud. This is a question that comes up quite regularly. It's nice to see someone bringing it up in the House of Commons this week. Why is it that so many of the bankers involved, international bankers, as Harry was talking about, seem to get away with crime and aren't arrested? So let's have a listen to that now.
Order. Let's have a bit of order for Mr. David Crosby. Yeah. When the great train robbers stole £2.5 million from Royal Mail, they were sentenced to as much as 30 years in prison. Yet when our bankers get caught fraudulently taking billions of pounds from poor people throughout the world, they just pay large corporate fines and walk away with fat pensions. How can we ever be in anything together as long as we tolerate powerful villains who are just too privileged to be put behind bars?
I think the Honourable Gentleman makes an important point, and that is why the Wheatley Review into the LIBOR scandal recommends a series of changes, including there being criminal sanctions. And I think when people have broken the law, they should face the full force of the criminal law. What punishment we should design for people who sold our gold at half price, on the other hand, is another matter altogether.
David Crosby there in the House of Commons, Prime Minister's questions, the last one of the year, Martin, on Wednesday. Is it enough to say shutting the stable door after the horse is bolted, say ultimately, oh, well, maybe there should be some criminal sanctions now after these crimes have been committed?
Well, surely the point is that crimes have been committed and they should have been prosecuted and they haven't been. A deal has been done, as they do in US courts. A deal has been done before it came to court. And of course, the problem with fining people when they carry out financial frauds is that whatever the fine is, and it's always the organisation that pays the fine, not individuals, the amount of money to be made through fraud is far in excess of that. So it's no deterrent. It's like paying a parking fine. And the Prime Minister, of course, then just launched into questions about selling of gold or whatever. It's a sort of party political point. But I mean, the wider point is, I think lots of people around the world are asking this, you know, if we're going to send people to prison for 2 years for stealing a bottle of water during a disturbance, why are we basically letting off bankers who've stolen billions?
Harry, what's your view of bankers who have fixed the LIBOR rates and stolen billions of pounds from people right across this country who are trying to pay their mortgages?
Well, it's becoming obvious that there's been a lot of really dirty work going on behind the scenes, whether in LIBOR or other parts of the banks. A question I wonder, should we ever have supported the banks or let them face their own fate? Mm-hmm. Maybe we'd have been better off to let them go about collapsing their own way and perhaps starting new ones. Whatever it is, we mustn't allow the banks to get away with that same system which has been ruining us for years.
But Harry, you can't surely just let a bank collapse and go bankrupt, because many of the people who've invested in that bank over the years may lose their savings.
Ultimately, the government is responsible for the people. But I don't see why banks should be allowed to gamble as they have done and use people's money for ill use. Time has come to split the banks, change them, make sure they're run on a proper and equitable basis.
Okay, and now from one end of the scale to the other, and this is about the working poor and those on benefits who are having to go to food banks.
We actually have helped those families with their bills, and we'll continue to do more in the future.
Mr. Speaker, I'm afraid that arsehole have seemed very out of touch with families up and down this country. And the problem is, what the Chancellor didn't tell us in the autumn statement was his tax on strivers will be hitting working families who rely on tax credits up and down the country. And the reality is that in the third year of his government, more children are going hungry and more families are relying on food banks. And isn't it the clearest indictment of his government's values that while lower and middle income families are being hit, at the same time he's giving an average of £107,000 tax cut to people earning over £1 million a year?
What is out of touch is denying the fact we had a deficit left by his government that we've had to deal with. That is what we've had to do. But we've been able to do it at the same time as cutting taxes for the poorest in our country, increasing child tax credits, and actually freezing the council tax to help those families. Now, when it comes to the top rate of tax, let me tell him, the richest in our country will pay more in tax under every year of this government than any year of his government. Those are the facts. He may not like them, but he can't deny them.
Speaker, the problem is nobody believes him anymore. And we know who this Prime Minister stands up for, because where was he last weekend? Back to his old ways, partying with Rebecca Brooks. No doubt both looking forward to the Boxing Day hunt, Mr. Speaker.
Well, that was Ed Miliband, of course, not Ed Davey. And the reason that he brought up the Boxing Day hunt, Harry, was because the hunt, David Miliband's local hunt there, I think it's at Hadfield, I think is the name of it, was actually caught breaking the law, doing illegal fox hunting. What are your thoughts about the sort of standard, really, of Prime Minister's question time these days? We've heard the Prime Minister there and the Leader of the Opposition. I mean, you've heard many of these speeches over the decades. What do you think about the modern Prime Minister's question? Is it much use these days?
You have to differentiate between much ado about really important things and much ado about nothing. When you compare all the noise and kerfuffle that's made about a hunt and hunting, which has gone on all through our history, and then you compare it with some of the important things like dealing with the banks, the difference is so great that it's a waste of our time and our money to preclude all the information which has been poured out to no satisfaction. Action is needed. Action should not be any longer delayed.
Martin, what are your thoughts there about that little exchange? Because he wasn't just talking about the hunt, he was using that to make a cheap point, but he was talking, Ed Miliband there, about what he called the tax on strivers, that is to say the low paid actually being taxed more, and tax breaks. He said there are £107,000 tax break for millionaires.
Well, it's that kind of debate between what you might call the Labour tradition and the Conservative tradition is a standard part of political discussion. It's been going on for generations. And, you know, the two sides are making the points you'd expect them to make.
Yes.
With the Labour Party saying, what about the workers, as it were, and the Conservative Party saying, well, what about, you know, you were running the show. In actual fact, David Cameron is right. There was lower taxes during the Labour government than actually previously under the Conservative government of Mrs. Thatcher, because she inherited a very high tax base from, the taxes increased in this country in the Second World War and the immediate aftermath. And there was a wide consensus about having high taxes on wealthy people at that stage, you know, to pay for the country's regeneration and so on. I think the other point, of course, is if we were independent of the EU and we took a country like Norway, which is outside of the EU, they have similar debates about how pain should be distributed, you know, whether the poor should pay more or the rich should pay more. But of course, in Norway, it's got a socialist tradition. They tend to be more on the socialist side of things. And incidentally, they chose not to be part of the EU because they saw the EU as a capitalist kind of institution driven by bankers, driven by the wealthy. And that was the reason why Norway stayed out of the EU. So it's not the same reason that you find in Britain, where people often see the EU as a socialist plot. In Norway, the ordinary folks saw the EU as a capitalist plot. But the point being, of course, that Norway are independent and can follow their own policy, which I think, is the point.
Well, what are your thoughts about Norway? Should we be a little bit more like them, yeah. Harry?
Yes. The Norwegians have a clear-eyed view of what works the situation. just as they had during the war. I have a great admiration for them, and I wish we could follow in their footsteps to a certain extent. But we have to remember that our common law is something we gave to the whole world. And if we follow our rights in the common law, we won't go far wrong.
Well, there's one subject that came up at question time this week in the House of Commons, which I think even Martin would think was well worthwhile, and that was a point about disabled people and the difficulties that they're having right now, many of them actually having their benefits taken away. And this is actually, Ian Lavery, MP, speaking in the House of Commons on Wednesday, and pretty much stunned silence after they realised what he was talking about.
Ian Lavery, Mr. Speaker, for having my hand a genuine suicide note from a constituent of mine who sadly took his own life after he was informed that he was no longer entitled to ASA and disability benefits.
Yeah.
And across the UK, there's over 1,000 people who have died only months after being told to find work. This is 2012. We're supposed to be a civilised society. Yeah. We should be looking after the disabled citizens here in the UK. Will the Prime Minister listen to the 62,000 people who signed Pat's petition? And finally, please, order an assessment of all changes hitting disabled people in this country.
I will look very carefully at the obviously very tragic case that the Honourable Gentleman brings to the House, and everyone's thoughts will go out to that person's family and to what has happened to them. What I would say to him is that the actual money we are putting into disability benefits over the coming years is going up and not down. But I think everybody knows and everyone accepts we need to have a review of disability benefits. Some people have been stuck on these benefits and not been reviewed for year after year after year. That is the view of the disability charities, and that's the view of the government as well.
That was David Cameron answering a question from Ian Lavery, MP, about the disabled suicide note that he was waving around in the House of Commons. Now, this is a pretty sad to be saying to disabled people, even if they have severe disabilities, that they are going to have to go out to work in a situation, Harry, where there's actually less and less jobs around, it seems, all the time.
Well, I think David Cameron gave a right answer this time, and I would support him in it. My view is that the situation we find ourselves with our wounded soldiers has opened our eyes and our conscience to what must be done to those who have fought gallantly for this country and finish up disabled. Now, we are actually doing something about them. And by the same token, I think we'll continue to expand our efforts with regard to all disabled. It should be a matter of close study, because it's on our conscience that we must look after our people, old and young, sick and poor, and those are the responsibility of every government.
But I mean, obviously that person who's committed suicide didn't feel that the government was looking after them.
That's right. And that's a situation which needs to be remedied. Now, it can't be done in one afternoon or one year. And David Cameron was quite correct when he said it takes time, that the motion is forward, action is being taken. And I think that within the next year, we'll see a terrific difference in regard to all our disabled.
Martin, there was a recent debate in the Commons about the effect of these cuts on disabled people. Only three Tory backbenchers turned up for it, including Cornwall MP Cheryl Murray, who accused disabled rights campaigners of causing an outbreak of fear-mongering and panic. Labour MPs gasped as left-winger John McDonnell, who we'll hear from after the 6 o'clock news, quoted tragic cases from the recent Spartacus report on disabled people and their carers. One person named John was so severely disabled he has to wear nappies and is fed through a tube, said Mr. McDonnell. He is blind and deaf, cannot speak, and suffers frequent seizures and requires 24-hour care. But he's now been told by a government decision-maker that he's capable of work.
I think there is a general consensus which developed in this country during the Second World War that old, disabled, sick people should be looked after. And I think that David Cameron was speaking from within that consensus. What the debate is whether the current government's policy is consistent with those goals. And of course, the opposition will be arguing that they are not. What strikes me as an economist is that one of the problems we've got is that we haven't got enough work for able-bodied people. There's a young friend of mine went for a job this week, which he was qualified to do. There were hundreds of applicants, and he didn't get it. He came second. He was a bit upset about that. Now, when you've got people like that finding it difficult to find work, how are people who have to put nappies on every day going to find work? And do employers want them? This is what the government doesn't seem to have thought through. If disabled people are going to be helped into work, and if they want to work, there's no reason why they shouldn't be. That actually often involves government spending and intervention. So REMPLOY was set up at the end of the Second World War to provide employment for people who had been disabled in the fighting, and they were REMPLOY has recently been closed down by the government because they had to subsidise it. Now, in fact, if you want disabled people to work, you've got to subsidise that. It's most unlikely that they're going to be able to work otherwise, and the economy as a whole, of course, isn't producing enough jobs for the able-bodied, and that's the real issue.
Can you see things changing, Harry, in the future so that that there will be more jobs? Because, I mean, there's no point in telling disabled people to go out and get jobs when even able-bodied people are finding it so difficult.
Well, first of all, economically, things are beginning to improve. And I am confident that they will get better and better. And as regards the disabled people, whoever they are, male, female, forces or civilians, I think our eyes and our minds have been opened in this past war in Afghanistan to realize the suffering that people actually have to go through before they get any kind of a remedy. It will take a long time, but I think the movement is positive and it is there.
Okay, we're coming up now to time for the Murdoch News at 6. Thanks to this week's guest. That's Bristol-born former army officer who also happens to be the longest-serving member of the Conservative Party anywhere in the country. That's Harry Beckhoff. After the news, we'll see if he can join us a bit, but we will then be looking at a parliament which is only as good as its opposition leader. After Labour leader Ed Miliband fell behind even Nick Clegg in the polls, could Labour ever be revived as a force to stick up for the 99%? We have an exclusive interview with Labour leadership candidate John McDonnell. Plus, the United States of Europe. As David Cameron openly talks of leaving the EU this week, we ask Harry what he makes of our prospects in Europe. Plus, Martin Summers' weekly tour of the world hotspots after the Murdoch News at 6.
This is BCFM 93.2, the community station for Bristol. Listen live online at bcfm.org.uk. BCFM News from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 6, a 7-year-old boy whose mother opposes him getting radiotherapy for a brain tumour will have the treatment. The High Court has ruled against Sally Roberts, who argued her son Neon could suffer long-term harm. Gwen Williams represents his father Ben, who's keen for him to have the treatment.
Neon's health and recovery has always been Mr. Roberts'.